MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein, and this is Spy Talk. Last month's spectacular terrorist attack on a concert venue on the outskirts of Moscow, which left 144 people dead, many, many more wounded, was quickly followed by startling news that U.S. intelligence had warned the Russians about the impending assault. When the Kremlin said the warnings hadn't been specific, moreover, U.S. officials pushed back, saying in effect, oh yes they were, and added details to its rejoinder. Likewise, it turned out that back in January, U.S. intelligence had warned Iran about an impending Islamic State terrorist attack at a gathering to honor its fallen Quds Force leader, Qasem Soleimani, who had been killed by a U.S. drone strike in Baghdad. The revelations that our spy services had actually warned two of our greatest mortal enemies astounded many people and triggered a lot of acidic commentary, confusion, and the inevitable conspiracy theories on social media. But my guest today, former CIA case officer and base chief, Laura Thomas, who held a number of senior intelligence positions during her nearly 16 years of government service, says those actions followed a standard practice in American intelligence. It's called a duty to warn. And she's here to explain how that seemingly esoteric, even confounding practice is not only a staple of the spy world, at least on the American side, but it has some espionage benefits as well. Laura Thomas, welcome back to Spy Talk. Great to have you again. The issue at hand is the concept of duty to warn. There's been a lot of reporting on and confusion about news that the U.S. intelligence community warned the Kremlin that a terrorist attack was coming last month, and it turned out to be a terrible attack, killing a lot of people, wounding a lot of people. And there's been follow-up reporting saying that the Russians didn't take it seriously or thought maybe it was a trick or deceit. So let's talk about this concept of duty to warn. What does that mean?
It is at its core, if something really bad is going to happen that could be significant loss of life, then CIA or whatever intelligence organization receives that information has a duty to warn the entity where that attack could occur, either the authorities or an individual, if it's an attack against a specific individual. And it's ultimately to try and help prevent loss of life.
But a lot of people are confused by the idea that we would warn Putin, our bellicose adversary, to say the least. Why would we warn them? There's an interesting intelligence and clandestine espionage angle to this, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, I'm not incredibly familiar with the Russia context, so I'm not commenting specifically on this, you know, latest Moscow warning or alleged warning to Moscow. But you would warn an adversary if you believe that the loss of life in that country will be such that, one, they're innocent civilians, their lives are at stake. There could be U.S. citizens that are in the area that could also, mm-hmm. you know, be wrapped up in an attack. Mm-hmm. There are also some other reasons other than just loss of life. If you're warning an adversary, you know, it could portray to that adversary, perhaps the intelligence organizations on the other side, that, wow, you know, the U.S. intelligence community does know quite a bit. And maybe if they're tracking this, what else are they tracking? And that can be used in a good way in the sense that CIA must know a lot. But also for an intelligence officer on the other side, wow, they would choose to do this and potentially, you know, help prevent a loss of life for an adversary. Perhaps they really do take care of their people to include their assets.
So there's kind of a freak out issue here. When you warn the Kremlin, when CIA warns, they slip a note, they request a meeting, let's say, in Moscow and say, we know that you're going to be hit hard by a terrorist attack. And we have a lot of the details on that. Maybe we don't know exactly when and where it'll happen, but we're pretty close to telling you that there's a freak out factor in Russian intelligence where they say, oh my God, they know so much about us that we don't even know. They must be all over us. Secondly, you're saying that a Russian intelligence officer who is disgusted by Putin's leadership, let's say, or pervasive corruption would say, well, gee, if the CIA knows that much about me, or U.S. intelligence knows that much about us, then they might protect me if I want to defect.
Yeah, that ideally that would be the case. I do think we also, you know, let's also not fool ourselves completely. Just because we as Americans think a certain way, and maybe I would find it to be noble that another country would warn us, even if we were their adversary, to prevent loss of life, perhaps that would not be perceived by certain services, certain countries, certain cultures as a noble or smart thing to do. So, you know, I don't want to pretend that the idea of trying to lure an adversarial intelligence officer across the line using duty to warn is just, you know, the most effective way at recruiting a foreign intelligence officer, because sometimes people just don't think the same, you know, that we do. Hmm. But at the end of the day, one thing that I think is worth being said is there is this North Star with CIA and in the US about the duty to protect innocent loss of life. And, you know, I know we can debate, well, then what about this? What about that? You know, CIA's done this in the past, you know, these wars. And not to say that there's not debate here, but generally in my experience at CIA and all the people that I worked with, there was a deep concern about innocence dying, and no one wanted to see that.
And you've indicated in your writing and your tweeting that this is very common, that you've experienced this a number of times. It sounds like you've written a number of cables back to headquarters saying, I have given a duty to warn to X country or X organization or individuals. Is that correct? It's pretty common.
I'm not able to comment on how common it is. Certainly, I've experienced it. Would I say that I'm a pro at duty to warn because I've just, you know, rattled them off so many different times? No, definitely not. It's not something that I think every CIA officer has done. But if you work on certain topics and in the field enough, you're probably going to run across it.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk a little bit about the mechanics of this, how it actually works. Now, as most people who listen to this podcast probably know, that the top CIA officer in any country is known to the host. He's a declared officer.
Or she, excuse me.
Thank you. How would it work? Would the chief of station, let's say, in some capital, call up his let's say in this case, Russia, a Russian counterpart, and say, we have specific warning, walk over, knock on his door, or call up and say, we need to meet. I've got some serious issue to deal with you here. Is that how it works?
It could be. Yeah. I mean, or it could be whatever officer is best positioned to issue that warning. There's mm-hmm. not a specific formula that one would use in every single scenario. Who is the best? Sort of the best athlete approach. Who's the best person to go do this? And there are all sorts of things you would think through. Is it someone that they've met with before that would be a familiar face? That of course they're going to pick up the phone. Of course they're going to meet with you. If it's someone that perhaps you've never met before, then what is the right officer to pair with that individual to make sure that the message is at least listened to and hopefully received in the best way possible?
Just goes to show you again that relationships are everything.
Yeah.
Well, in life in general, but in particularly in an intelligence field, knowing each other, anticipating each other's moves, having insight into the adversary is very, really, and partners is very, really, really important. Now, in the case of Russia, according to public reporting and U.S. Officials who have addressed this issue, the Russians didn't really take our warning on the concert terrorist attack seriously. I suspect that is not uncommon among adversaries where we give them a warning and they say, what are you up to? They expect some trickery.
Yeah. You know, I don't know the case with Russia, and Russia wasn't a topic that I worked on when I was at the agency. But in general, and I think this goes to any large bureaucracy, and I would include the United States in this, U.S. government, often an inaction is not necessarily because people didn't have the right information or there was an intention to do the right thing, but it's just when you have a big bureaucracy, there's a lot of incompetence and there can be arrogance, and it's just a system. And the system doesn't always work in the right ways that it should work.
Give me an example.
Well, I mean, you could point out all the different intelligence failures that are publicly known over the last 40 years or so. I think would probably, you would go back and if you forensically look at it, you could say, well, this person did report and they did know, and yet they still failed to stop an attack. Obviously, I think the biggest one on people's minds recently is Hamas and their attack on October 7th against Israel. I mean, looking back on it forensically, we see that there were people reporting up that there was movement. Some of the superiors didn't take it seriously. You have an over-reliance on SIGINT. You probably had a not very good humit occurring in Gaza at the time. And you have, you know, an arrogance in the sense of, we've got this wired. We don't think that they have the will or the intent to do this, and they're focused on other things.
And let's whittle that down a little bit, the Hamas-Gaza situation. We've reported, based on our intelligence sources, that CIA kind of farmed out coverage of Gaza and Hamas to the Israelis. I mean, it's their backyard. It's a domestic problem for them. We're much more interested in Hezbollah, which we're all over all the time, or supposedly, tracking very, very closely via Beirut and other places. But we weren't paying close attention to Hamas because that was an internal Israeli program. So we were involved in a duty to warn situation there. Is that correct?
I mean, certainly if we had information that would have prevented or somehow notified folks of something that we didn't think they knew, then yeah, we would have passed that, in my view. I mean, like, I don't know exactly what happened in that scenario, but Israel is considered an ally.
So,
I mean, it would almost be part of a normal, you know, liaison relationship. It wouldn't necessarily be a duty to warn. It would just be, of course, you're going to share information with allies.
Now, we, according to public reporting and based on conversations with current U.S. officials, we gave Iran early warning of a terrorist attack in Iran by militants inside the country. Now that's got to be a really interesting conversation to have with the Iranians. And according to some of the reporting, they didn't believe it either, in the same way that the Kremlin didn't really take our warnings of the terrorist attack outside of Moscow very seriously. So that's a really important issue. Now, going to extremes here, Israel says it's going to hit Iran. If we had plans, just speaking theoretically here on this duty to warn tradition or practice, if we had early warning of Israel's plans to attack, of Israel's exact plans to attack Iran, are we going to warn Iran about that?
Absolutely not.
So duty to warn has its limits.
Absolutely. I mean, you have to use common sense. And there's actually a regulation. It's ICD 191. If you go up, you can see that there are carve outs for if you're in an active war zone or an entity that has essentially declared war or done something warlike, then no, you're not going to go and warn them that someone's going to respond to your attack. So there is no, you know, this is not something that's so set in stone that people can't follow good judgment or common sense. And that's, sometimes government in a bureaucracy, you have bureaucratic regulations and sadly, common sense goes by the wayside. I think in the duty to warn scenario, you know, people are using their best judgment.
And it's not as if an Israeli attack on Iran would be a big secret. I mean, they're saying
they are preparing for that. I mean, the Iranians have to, presumably, they are preparing for it. Israel has said that they will respond. I would expect that they are going to respond. So why would we, you know, we're not going to warn them about something they already know.
You brought up some rule that you cited, had an acronym to it. Is there a rule on duty to warn? Is that what you were referring to?
Yeah, it's essentially a regulation, which is different from a law. So,
sure.
But yeah, it's codified. It's a codified responsibility that the intelligence community has, and it as I understand it, it's not limited to CIA. It's the broader community.
Is there ever reciprocity? I mean, do our adversaries have similar rules? I can't. I mean, that sounds like a silly question, even as it passes my lips.
I'm sure in some point in history that an adversary intelligence organization specifically has warned CIA. But as a common expectation? No, I highly doubt it. Though, of course, you know, I've not worked every single target out there, so I wouldn't necessarily know. But in my experience, no, I've never heard of a specific warning from an adversary.
In your experience, you've never heard of China, Russia, much less Pakistan, warning us of a terrorist attack.
It could be that they are, but it's not a duty to warn in a codified. What I'm saying is it's not a codified thing. Like if they want to warn us because they believe it will gain them whatever leverage in negotiations or goodwill that somehow they think will be beneficial to them. What I'm saying is I think that's a bit different when you look at it from the U.S. perspective, which I do believe comes out of truly a sense of trying to protect innocent loss of life, rather than we're only going to use this duty to warn in order to buy ourselves some sort of leverage over another country. That doesn't mean that we don't want to find some leverage in it, but that's not the ultimate foundation of the duty to warn, in my view.
Do you have an idea when this began, when this rule was promulgated? Was it during the formation of the CIA in 1947, or was there a particular incident that made U.S. officials say, you know, we really got to get on the right side of this issue? Do you know when it began?
I don't know. I have heard around 2015 that's when it began. I was there before that. So there was never a point in time where I'm like, oh, now there's a duty to warn. It's just always been something that I was familiar with since the beginning. So mm-hmm. Even if it was not codified, I believe that it was something that was still carried out as a courtesy.
Mm-hmm. And you say during your career, you were involved in duty to warn machinations, let's call them.
Yeah.
What kind of response did you get? I know you can't talk about specific incidents, but can you talk in general about what kind of response you got when you approached an adversary service and said, you better button up, there's an attack coming? Can you describe that a little bit?
Just an acceptance, very stoic-like response.
Stoic-like. What are you trying to do? Are you screwing with my mind?
Yeah, I mean, and I don't know that I would expect much different. Where it would get a little more interesting is, you know, if you're meeting with an intelligence officer in an adversarial country and it's more, you do have some sort of personal relationship, maybe not a recruited, you know, they're not your recruited asset. They're trying to recruit you as well. You know, there can be legitimate, maybe affection is a strong word, maybe not the right word, but at least some level of respect and, you know, you appreciate the interactions with each other. And then
dare I say honor among thieves.
I take issue. I was not a fully a thief. I stole good information.
Of course. I mean, you never stole any bad information.
Look, ultimately, yes, are you doing the same job? Yes. But do you have the same ends and intentions? And I do think intentions matter. I think they matter a lot. And I think it would be a false equivalency to compare one thief versus another thief and use necessarily that term.
I love your description of your counterpart being stoic. And you mentioned about, you know, convincing this person of the honesty of your intentions. It was really to save lives. I suspect that counterpart in that situation was quite taken aback and probably disbelieving.
Yeah, look, when you come from other countries where, you know, conspiracy thinking is rife, because truly those countries do engage in a lot of conspiracy. And that's changing in the U.S., sadly. I think conspiracy theory, we've always had it, but it's definitely growing. People think that way for a reason. It's because in their governments, there are these, you know, grand conspiracies and plots that people are constantly having to deal with. So I don't think it's abnormal that you would be met with some level of disbelief. You know, I think one important thing to say also is duty worn isn't just for, you know, adversaries. It is also for people, individuals. So if there's an individual who maybe they're not an adversary, but we know that they're under threat because of something that CIA knows, CIA is almost certainly going to do what it can to warn that individual, even if it has no bearing. It doesn't help CIA in some way.
You know, that conjures up for me a scene from The Godfather where, you know, one gangster family is warning another gangster family that, you know, the knives are out for you and you better take care. And it's up to you how you react to that and what you do. But we caution calm to keep the peace between the families. And of course, but conspiracy thinking, you know, in the Middle East where the United States, let's face it, the track record is, you know, the United States provoked a coup in Iran, put the Shah in power. We involved in coups in Syria and elsewhere and so on. So there's a long legacy and they don't forget that.
No, they don't, and they shouldn't.
Especially the Iranians.
And there have been things that the U.S. government has done that it's never apologized for whatever reason. We think it's going to show weakness. You know, we can debate that until we're blue in the face. Yeah, there is legitimate reasons for conspiracy thinking by some of these countries. What I will say is that so much has changed since, you know, that I don't even know the exact date, but, you know, 1980s, 90s, moving forward, you know, coup making and plotting, that was just never part of my time at the agency. And I get that people are going to hear me say that and be like, sure, you know, she's being paid to say that, or, you know, they're going to have a conspiracy mindset about that. But, you know, it wasn't my experience, but reading about the history of the agency that came way before my time. Yeah, there was a lot going on. Apparently, you know, I don't know, I wasn't there at the time, but it was pretty mind-blowing of some of the stuff they were attempting to do and just how unsuccessful it was. And I think from that, a lot changed and for the better.
Well, you know, we brush these things off. We go on. We're so internally, domestically focused America traditionally. We're seeing it again, the strong strain of America First in American politics today. But to these countries that are affected, you know, we're the elephant squashing mosquitoes. And the 1953 coup that overthrew Mossadegh in Iran is the principal event of their modern history. It drives their, at least the leadership's, hatred for America.
Oh, I think a lot more than that drives it. It's a sense of truly feeling like they should be the regional power in the Middle East, that their version of Islam is the right one. I mean, I think there's so much beyond Mossadegh that would drive a mindset of Iranian leadership today. But, you know, on the flip mm-hmm. side of that, when you have potential sources who believe that the U.S. does have a lot of power and it does play and legitimately does play a quite significant role in the world, that's the power that you can try to go to intercede and help change things if you don't like the way things are going. Mm-hmm. And that's a very powerful force to feel like you can ally yourself with someone or an entity that can truly affect change if you feel powerless.
Yeah, this is where national traditions and myths and reputations comes to play. There are, in this generation of Iranians and Americans, there's a common bond, or at least CIA can approach possible Iranian sources with the mutual desire to rid Iran of dictators and corruption and its theocracy.
Yeah.
So.
And look, there's a long history of Russia playing a role in that country, a very negative role. I mean, you know, there are so many threads that one can pull on the Iran topic just alone. But you know, what I think it comes back to, and what you said earlier, relationships and building empathy and building trust, being willing to listen, hear them out. They do have a lot of conspiracy views about the United States. That's fine. I want to listen to that. I want to hear how they think, how they feel. You know, there are perhaps things the U.S. did in the past that I can personally, when I was a U.S. government official, I can apologize for. That's very powerful. Even if the U.S. government won't do it as the U.S. government writ large, that's extremely, you know, it builds trust and it shows true empathy. Something that happened in the past, I'm not responsible for. I'm really sorry it happened. Let's make sure it doesn't happen again.
Yeah, we've touched on this many times with former CIA officers like yourself. And as you know, I went through case officer training myself. And there's no small emphasis on listening and empathy to win over someone's trust. And it can't be just empty words either. You have to approach foreigners with, you know, without any myth-making.
Yeah. And there has to be some legitimacy to it, too. It can't be all a charade on your behalf. And you can do it that way, but people pick up on that pretty quickly. And it usually does not. It's not a long-term relationship or long-term beneficial.
Mm-hmm. You know, you went public talking about duty to warn in social media and so forth because you were distressed by false narratives about duty to warn. For example, what did you mean about that?
Just, you know, I saw a lot of the typical comments. Well, you know, did you warn certain dictators before you were about to oust them? And it's things like that. It's like, okay, fair point. The CIA has apparently, again, I don't know the records. I wasn't looking into what we were doing in classified research in the 1950s. But from, you know, many books that have been written, fair point. But let me tell you how I have experienced it working in more modern times.
So you just sort of move aside that criticism and get back on the topic that you want to deal with your adversary, your counterpart in this turbulent world. Now, someone raised a very good question. You said you'd write about it later. This was on X, formerly known as Twitter, said, Would we warn Putin of a plot to overthrow him? You said, that's a really interesting question. I'm going to write about that later. How about tipping your hand here and letting us know what you would say?
Yeah, I don't have a great answer for that right now. Generally, I think Putin knows that he's under threat from a multitude of different angles. One aspect of the duty to warn, if someone reasonably believes that their life is under threat, you don't have to warn them that their life is under threat. You're already telling them what they already know. So no, I mean, that would just be a waste of time for both parties.
But that dodges the question a little bit, I have to say. If we got specific knowledge of let's say, Ukrainian plot to assassinate Putin when he was in a certain place. Mm-hmm. Would we warn him, do you think?
I don't know what current leadership would decide, what the person on the ground would decide.
That raises another really interesting question. How far up do these decisions go? For example, the decision to warn the Russians about the terrorist attack at the concert venue. Do you think that went to White House leadership?
I don't know about White House. I would imagine that if it's something, you know, to that magnitude, I would expect that seniors at CIA would have would have known about it in advance.
Well, we've been very public. The CIA and national security officials have been very public because the Russians dismissed the notion that we had given them warning. And then U.S. National security officials says, oh, yeah, well, we were really specific. And this is what we told you. Bop, 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 bop. And when Russians dug in and they said, no, you didn't. We said, oh, yeah, well, we told you this, this, and this. Yeah. So there was a
back and forth. Yeah. And I, what I'm saying is, in advance of the decision to carry out a duty to warn like that, I would expect that the most senior levels of CIA leadership would be tracking that that was about to happen. Mm-hmm. Whether or not the White House knew, I don't know. I would imagine, but you know, that again, Russia's not a topic that I'm is really in my background, so I don't know.
Let's say there was a plot to assassinate Xi Jinping, and it was brought to a Trump White House, and CIA, U.S. intelligence officials, you know, stated in the Oval Office, well, we believe it's our duty to warn, to tell the Chinese president that there's an attack coming on him or a major terrorist attack in Beijing.
Yeah. Good thought experiment. I mean, I don't know that CIA would go to the president, Trump or any president, Biden. That's not something, you know, you have agencies, you have people that you hire, you empower them and hope that they make good decisions. I mean, that's what they're supposed to be there for. So you wouldn't have to appeal to the highest authority in the nation to decide to issue a warning. I think even if it were against a foreign leader, but again, if you're a foreign leader, reasonably, I mean, every foreign leader knows that someone somewhere wants to take them out. But I get to your point is, well, what if you had very specific information about it? You know, look, I think generally assassinations are a thing of the past. Now, I know we could parse that much further down.
We could.
But especially like a foreign leader themselves, outside of a war zone, I think that would be pretty significant and destabilizing if it were known that we knew something so enormous that, you know, was about to happen. I think the framework we would think about it is, okay, then would we be seen by the people, by our own people, by foreigners, by that country as culpable?
As if it emerged.
The person carrying it out, because even if we had nothing to do with it, but because we knew and we didn't say something, I think that would be weighed. I think they would have to weigh all those, you know, different sort of considerations.
It's great grist for a spy novel, you know?
It is. If someone out there is listening, write on it.
CIA station chief in Beijing learns about this warring. There's going to be an attack on Xi, an assassination plot, goes to his counterpart in Chinese intelligence, and the White House advisory is saying, don't let him take it. You know, we're not going to warn them. You know, we'd be better off with Xi Jinping dead. Anyway, great stuff for a spy novel. And maybe you'll write it. In the meantime, last time you were here, last summer, Laura, we talked about women at the CIA. Is that a dead horse now, a dead issue? Because so many women have climbed to the top rungs of U.S. intelligence. Are we beating a dead horse there? Should we just stop talking about that, or is it still an issue?
Look, I think it's still an issue in terms of, is there complete equality at CIA? No. But have there been wonderful strides made? Yes. And, I think we have to just empower people, the right people in that organization. And what I am against are all these different commissions and working groups and panels. That really just muddies the system, in my view. And it's not to say that certain, you know, I think people should be able to speak up and out and change needs to happen. But when you start trying to adjust an organization's response by committee and by something that sounds great on paper, but maybe is just, you know, a talking point in and of itself, then that's not very helpful either.
Yeah, it's an ages old issue and a mechanism in Washington. You want to, you know, kick the can down the road, you form a commission and study it.
Right. And I guess my point is there are so many really big challenges that the agency faces. And do I think that women, you know, the inequality of women is the biggest challenge that organization needs to fix? No. Does that mean it doesn't need to fix it? No. I think that there are better ways to address it, which is addressing just generally the mediocrity that we sometimes see in a bureaucracy. You can change that, then you change sort of the downward sort of cascading effects of that, which will include, you know, a lack, I think, of some of the awful, you know, examples and stories we've heard about women's mistreatment.
Absolutely. I must say, I keep hearing, I've heard for years, I've been writing about this for decades now, the constant refrain is mediocrity of middle management at CIA. And of course, it could be at the Federal Trade Commission too,
yeah. So
CIA. Yeah. You know, CIA is a critical mission agency, an action agency where mediocrity can really put the glue in the works of a promising operation, or you know, really screw it up, or not take the appropriate action, being overcautious and so on. And I'm going to keep addressing this down the line because I don't know how you get rid of mediocrity. I'm personally very pleased with the leadership so far that Bill Burns has shown. I think he's a gifted leader, I must say. I hate to be proven wrong, you know, tomorrow. But right now, it's nice to have someone in there that I think someone we can admire on many levels. So Anyway, Laurie, you're always a great guest. Thanks so much. Yeah. And thanks for throwing some light on this contentious or confused issue of duty to warn. And we're going to see a lot down the road on this issue for sure.
Right. My pleasure. Thanks, Jeff.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive at the MSW Network or on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do leave us a comment, good or bad. We love hearing from listeners. And if you haven't already, do check out the Spy Talk news site on Substack, where our deeply experienced contributing writers offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. And that spooky sound bed you've been hearing, that's called Ghost by the Dutch composer Tim Beek. We found it on YouTube. Enjoy. I'm Jeff Stein for Spy Talk.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.